So let me start by just making a remark, which I should have done last earlier, but I'm not sure I did. So how does a string theory scattering amplitude look like? Suppose I have, you know, n external legs. So this is a perturbative expansion. We know that we are supposed to sum of the number of loops, which is called the genus for a Riemann surface. The result of some integrals or some moduli spaces of Riemann surfaces with genus n and then punctures. I just wanted to remark that, so as a perturbative expansion, as you can imagine, we need to put some coupling, some power of the coupling here. And we call it G string. And I just wanted to write down the explicit power. So clearly it increases as G increases. So that the actual expression is something like 2G minus 2 plus N. Okay. So for example, an amplitude which has three external legs.
Where is this expression coming from now? Or 2G minus
2? Well, it's probably easiest to first give some examples and then motivate it better. So for example, when you have something with three external legs, you're gonna it will start at genus zero with a factor of just of the coupling, which makes sense. And then at the one loop level, we'll have a power of G string cubed, etc. If you look at something with four external legs, it is start to the G string squared, etc. And to convince yourself that these powers make sense, just think about the quantum field theory amplitude. Something like this has one power of the coupling. Something like this would have two powers of the coupling. Something like this would have three powers of the coupling. Something, say like this, would have four powers of the coupling. Now, within string theory, another way to think about why this power is that this power can be written in a way which is very local on the worksheet. If you just integrate the curvature on the worksheet, you're going to get this number. So this sort of makes sure that when you glue together worksheets and try to check things like unitarity of a perturbative expansion, everything will work out properly.
So you said that when we have four legs, we have two powers of the coupling.
Mm-hmm.
But in that amplitude, we have it at genus zero, right?
Yes.
And that has like no loops, so.
Yeah, but there's still three interactions. Now you can use different types of conventions when you think about the coupling of the perturbative expansion. If you want to think about it as an expansion in 1 over h bar, in bars of h bar, say, really, then you can change the conventions for what's the price that you pay for external legs. So this will become, like if you did that, then this will become g to the minus 2. So, right, so you could say, I change my normalization for external legs and eliminate this. Then the first term will behave like 1 over g squared, which is sort of 1 over h bar. Classical. The next term would be no power of h bar. Okay. The next term was h bar, but you know, and so on. So roughly, you should think about this coupling as something which sits in front of the whole Lagrangian. If this was a quantum field theory, So the first calculation I would like to do is to compute this for the simplest possible situation. So I want to compute a process. The process I put on the board last Friday, okay, where I have three string states, and I put a tachyon. State in each of the external legs. Remember that things are on shell, tachyons are on shell if their momentum squared is 2 in the most Laplace's convention. So as we discussed last week, we can map this to calculation on a sphere with CC bar e to the IPX sort of insertions. And then we can evaluate it. So use the fact that the ghost amplitude gives us z1 minus z2 absolute value squared, z1 minus z3 absolute value squared, z2 minus z3 squared. Notice that this factorizes into an holomorphic and anti-holomorphic part. All calculations involving the ghosts have this property. Because the Lagrangian is simply something involving holomorphic ghosts plus something involving anti-holomorphic ghosts. And they don't talk to each other. And then I need the scalar field amplitude, correlation function better, on the sphere. Now, this can be computed as I discussed last week. There was a piece of the formula which I, of course, forgot to mention. Which is momentum conservation. This momentum is a conserved quantity. These vertex operators carry a charge under those currents. These currents are not anomalous, they have no problem at all. So a correlation function only is non-zero only if the total charge is non-zero, is zero. So there is a big delta function. If you want this guy acts on the vacuum carrying something momentum p, then this acts on the on that bring the momentum to p2 plus p3, then this makes it to p1 plus p2 plus p3, and then you contract to the other vacuum and you get the delta function. Okay, so we can combine these two expressions. Thank you. Okay. Now, this point is we need to use the on-shell condition. So this you can simplify this expression further, because recall that P1 squared is equal to 2, P2 squared is equal to 2, P3 squared is equal to 2. But P3 is minus P1 plus P2. So this 2 actually equals 2 plus 2 plus 2 P1 dot P2. Which means this expression is actually 0. And it drops out. This is as it should be. The precise position of these 3 points on the sphere is a pure gauge piece of information. I could have used an holomorphic transformation of this form to move these 3 functions wherever I wanted on the sphere while keeping the metric spherical. So the answer should not depend on that for on-shell external states. Well, precisely the invariance under gauge transformations is ensured by Bierest invariance, and these states are Bierest invariant only if these on-shell conditions are satisfied. And indeed, when they're satisfied, you get an answer which is independent of Z1, Z2, Z3. And it's just, you know, the normal thing you would associate for 3 scalar fields, for the interaction of 3 scalar fields. That's a normal interaction vertex. Now we can have a bit more fun. Actually, let's have fun here. If you change one of the external states into a graviton, suppose now I take my states. Actually, sorry, are there any questions about these calculations? So suppose I want to replace one of the states, say, okay, so let me keep two of these as tachyons, but let me consider a graviton vertex operator. Remember, the graviton vertex operator is obtained from this state. Okay. All on shell. So the only new piece of information we need is how to modify this calculation when we insert the vertex operator corresponding to this state. Now that vertex operator is simply this. So A minus 1 and A minus 1 bar are implemented by putting derivatives of the scalar field. You can check, for example, that the conformal dimension matches and other properties match.
The epsilon?
Yes, I should put the epsilon too. I mean, this is defined even, I don't put an epsilon. So to do this calculation, you just do weak contractions. Essentially, you get extra weak contractions where one of these guys is contracted with this or this. And when this guy is contracted with this or this. So you get something that looks like this. And then the same. Okay. See, I was using the fact that the, you know, the 2-point function between x and del x is 1/(z − w). Okay, so we can plug this in here. Let me use don't share conditions. Okay, so for now you only use don't share conditions. Now to proceed further, I should remember that there is also a condition of transversality. So if I impose that this is killed by L0, I get the condition that p squared is 0. If I impose that this is killed by L1 commuting with A1, sorry, L1 acting on this, sorry, will produce something proportional to epsilon mu nu p mu. So there is a condition like this, which is just the statement that the graviton is transverse. You should not have a longitudinal polarization of the graviton. So when you use this condition together with the condition that the momenta add up to 0, this tells you that p shu contracted with epsilon is equal to minus p1 contracted with epsilon. So I can bring out an overall factor. And now when you do this subtraction, you get on top z1 minus z3. And so you cancel exactly these factors. And this is a very reasonable interaction vertex for a graviton interacting with a scalar field. You know, if I just hide this, you would see the interaction vertex for a photon interacting with a charged particle. This is just the corresponding thing for a graviton. Any questions?
That minus 2 in the Z1 minus Z2?
Yes.
It's on purpose that it's a minus 2, or should it be the 2?
No, it was a minus 2.
Okay.
And it cancels against the numerator in this expression. See, because now p3 squared is 0, the conditions change. For example, true p1, p2 is now minus 4. And true p2 dot p3 is now 0. Okay. So you can, you know, keep doing these sort of exercises. For example, with a little bit of help from Mathematica, you could look at the scattering amplitude of 3 gravitons and reproduce the interaction vertex for 3 gravitons and match it with the perturbative gravity calculations. And I thought this looks like a somewhat longish calculation. It turns out that these sort of calculations are actually much easier than what you would do if you were to compute three-level amplitudes, say, of gravitons. If you had to compute a three-level amplitude of six gravitons, you would probably have to adapt thousands of three-level Feynman diagrams. A three-level calculation with six gravitons here, it's actually quite less dramatic.
And let's say that we are, calculating this guy, the amplitude for for a scalar field, but not to say tangent, scalar fields and a graviton.
Yes.
What kind of perturbative process are we describing? Some scalar field, like physically interacting with a gravitational wave, like what that graviton? Where would I see it?
Well, this vertex first of all tells you what is the gravitational field sourced.
Okay.
By a particle, okay. A scalar particle. And then, yes, this could also be now, this process of three tachyons can easily be on shell. Mm-hmm. If you have three space-like momenta, there is no problem to have them adapt and have length two. I think this can also be on shell. But the fact that these things exist on shell is a little bit special to tachyons, right? A normal scalar field would not just emit on shell photon or graviton. But then this ends up as a piece of more complicated calculations also. The other thing I want to say is that, so this sort of calculations are the first hint that calculations with gravitons or photons can be done in much simpler ways than using Feynman diagrams. There's a whole industry now on how to do calculations, even three-level calculations for gauge theory and gravity without using Feynman diagrams. And some of the ideas they're using came from the sort of early string theory calculations. Now, next I would like to move to a four-point amplitude. So there's only one point I would like to clarify. So strictly speaking, we should do this. We should have C bar with some vertex operators at four locations. The sphere. Okay. Then we should add an extra insertion of B and B bar. And then integrate the whole thing on whatever parameter we're using to parameterize the choice of metric. So as I anticipated one of the other times, one natural choice is to use the position of one of the punctures as a way to parameterize your space of compass structures. So now you need to understand how do you describe an infinitesimal change of the metric which moves one of the punctures without changing anything else. Well, if you want to take the puncture and move it, the easiest way is to change the metric in a sort of annular region around your puncture. So these integrals, so when I write something like this, I really mean an integral of these expressions. But I can restrict my change of the metric in an annular region around my puncture, so that it essentially becomes a contour integral of B. See, literally, I mean, I don't want to do the calculation in detail, but if you can easily pick a change in an infinitesimal change on the metric, and convince yourself that the result becomes something like this. That if you take your metric to change just on a little annular region, you can rewrite these integrals, which are integrals on the whole surface, as integrals on a contour. And then using the state operator map, you can also convince yourself that integrating away, or just using the OPEs of the ghosts, you can convince yourself that doing a contour integral like this has the effect of just killing the C ghost. See, if I have a contour integral around the point, I only get some contribution if there is a pole. The only pole here comes from B hitting C, or B bar hitting C bar. And the residue is one, because the OPE of B and C is of this form. So that means that these integrals are just eliminating C and C bar. So all you are left with is an integral of V of the matter part over the Z bar. Now, if you want to convince yourself that this makes sense, you can also observe that this guy has dimension 1, 1. So the conformal dimensions of this guy are 1, both in the holomorphic and automorphic side, which means if you do a coordinate transformation, this picks a power of the Jacobian and the complex conjugate, which is precisely what cancels against his. So this sort of expression is actually quite reasonable. You can also check that if you act by hand with a BRST charge on something like this, it's true that this is not closed, but Q of this is a total derivative. So once you integrate it, you are pretty safe, unless there are boundary terms from the collision with other terms, which have interesting physical meanings, but I'm going to ignore for now. Okay. So those boundary terms correspond to sort of infrared divergences in quantum field theory. They don't appear here in this particular situation, but in loop calculations they would play a role. So let's do this calculation. We need something like this. Let's just do 4 tachyons for simplicity. Okay. Doing other states is not conceptually different, it's just a bit more computationally involved. And then So this is straightforward. We need the generalization of this formula to 4 vertex operators. It just means that we get now 6 terms like this, because there is 1 for each pair of vertex operators. There is still an overall delta function. So this looks like this. So nothing particularly surprising. These are the three terms that come from collision from these sort of vector operators combined the Gauss contribution, and these are the ones that come from these with the other three. Now, is this sensible? Let's see what are the possible places where these integrals could go wrong. At infinity, first of all, let's make sure that it doesn't diverge at infinity. There was no vertex operator inserted at infinity. Let's make sure that nothing goes wrong there. The total power of z is something like 2p4 dot p1 plus p2 plus p3. But this is equal to minus 2p4 squared, which is minus 4. So this behaves at infinity as z4 to the minus 4. So it's a fine behavior, perfectly integrable. Now, it's another possibly dangerous place is when z4 approaches zi, because in principle, this could be negative, could be quite negative. So in particular, this integral will diverge if 2p4 dot pi gets greater or equal to minus 2, is smaller than or equal to minus 2. Now you can write this you can rewrite this. It's just the statement this will diverge if p4 plus pi squared was smaller than 2. You can recognize this from quantum field theory. See, if you write the propagator as we are doing in terms of Zwinger times, Euclidean signature, this only makes sense if p squared is greater than minus m squared. If not, you have a naive divergence, which is precisely that for a tachyon in internal line. So the way you deal with this in field theory is that you can just weak rotate. You can either weak rotate tau to a Lorentzian Zwinger time, or you can analytically continue this from a region where the integral converges. So you take p squared to be large enough, and then you analytically continue back. Here you could do either. But traditionally, people do the analytic continuation from the region where this is positive, bigger than 2. Notice that because this is a trailer of amplitude, the only divergences are poles, so it doesn't really matter which way you analytically continue. In a loop amplitude, you have to be a bit more careful because there will be cuts, and then only some very specific path correspond to analytic continuation from Euclidean to Lorentzian signature. But this would really bring us beyond the scope of these lectures. So let's do this integral It's not obvious that this will be, is independent of the ZIs, of course. But there is a neat coordinate transformation which makes it obvious. So you can define a parameter t as z4 minus z1 over z4 minus z3, normalized by z2 minus z3 over z2 minus z1. This is called the cross ratio. A way to think about this is that it's just one of those coordinate transformations on the sphere. It's a transformation which is selected to set z1 to 0, z2, z3 to infinity, and z2 to 1. And then t is the location of z4. So if you use this coordinate transformation in there, the integral just simplifies. Something that does not depend on the ZIs. Or, I mean, doesn't depend on Z1, Z2, and Z3. Of course, it depends on Z4 because that's what we're integrating over. Okay. So this is the integral we need to compute. It's not that bad. It's a relative to the beta integral. You can do it in many different ways. For example, you can try to rewrite these as Gaussian integrals. Sorry, as e to the minus t minus x t squared integrated over x, and then do the Gaussian integral, and so on and so forth. The result is something called the Virasoro-Shapiro amplitude. And I should not forget, of course, the delta function of momentum conservation. Okay, so it looks like this. It's a pretty compact expression, but it contains a lot of physics. And I would like to spend the remainder of the lecture to unpack some of this physics, assuming we can keep it visible. Any questions, though, on how we got to this? Must be a way to balance these boards. Okay. So that's probably gonna create an accident after the lecture. So remind me please to take it off. So it's useful to use Mandelson variables. Mandelson variables are the mass squared of whatever particle you're propagating in an intermediate channel, S channel, T channel, or U channel. So in terms of these variables, the amplitude looks like this. Okay. So the first question you can ask is, what are the poles of this amplitude, right? In quantum field theory, three-level amplitudes have poles where the internal momentum goes on shell. This expression has poles on the gamma functions in the numerators. These poles are where S is. Where the mass squared. So remember, the gamma function is a pole at 0, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, minus 4. So you're going to find poles where S is equal to minus 2, 0, 2, 4, 6, and so on. Or when T is equal to minus 2, 0, 2, 4, etc. So this corresponds to the exchange of a tachyon in intermediate channel. This corresponds to exchanging a massless particle, like a graviton. There's the particle of charge 2, charge 4, so mass 2, mass square 2, mass square 4, mass square 6, and so on. These are just the, this is just the infinite tower of string modes. You can compute the residues of this expression. So you can compute the residue of A where, say, P4 dot P1 is minus n, okay? When you compute the residue, you get a lot of constellations between numerator and denominator. So naively, the residue has some gamma functions at the denominator and some factorials at the numerator. But things actually simplify a lot. And so you get something that is a polynomial. In the momentum, whose degree depends on which level we are. Again, this makes sense. Scattering amplitudes which have an intermediate state of some spin tend to have polynomial behavior in the momentum whose power is controlled by that spin. So if you look at the so, for example, right, the tachyon pole appeared when this is minus 1, when n is equal to 1. When n is equal to 1, there is nothing here. You just get 1. When you exchange a scalar field, you just get an interaction term here, which is proportional to 1, another interaction here, which is proportional to 1, and the whole thing is just a constant as a function of momentum, at least there, plus times the propagator, of course. Now, suppose I'm looking at something which involves a graviton. Well, now the interaction vertex for the graviton has two momenta. So I get some momenta, two momenta here and two momenta here. I get four momenta. Indeed, in here. Now, here is problem. I think I must stop one of these. There is a mistake in this formula, I think, but this should give you an appropriate power set, you know, four powers of the momentum, which I wonder where did I make a mistake. This is probably an n minus one or something like that. Sorry, that would make sense. I had to double check.
Just give an example of n equals to 1.
Right. So the tachyon should have no powers of momenta. The graviton should have 4. The next level of the string spectrum, you have particles which have spin 4. And so their interactions involve 4 momenta, because you need 4 Lorentz indices when a particle with spin 4 is on this leg. And so you have increasing powers of the momenta. These powers of the momenta are the reason for which theories of gravity or higher spin particles are not normalizable. perturbative amplitudes tend to behave very badly at high energy, and when you integrate these particles over loops, you get divergences. Now, what happens to this amplitude where we make the energies big? So it turns out that the operation of taking the residues or sending the energies to be large do not quite commute. If you take this expression and you send S and T and U to be very large, A just behaves like this. You can use the Stirling formula for the gamma function to recover this. So, although each individual term, each individual string mode, which has high spin, contributes power law behavior, when you add them all up, you get something which actually decays exponentially fast. So if you scatter two strings very hard against each other, they just pass across each other. They don't bounce off at some generic angle. So somehow in this amplitude, this infinite tower of particles is conspiring so that the high energy behavior is vastly improved. Okay, so as I said, not much more work. You could now take this technology and use it to compute, say, scattering of four gravitons, say, or some other string modes. In particular, you could say, okay, I have my low energy string modes, I can compute all their scattering amplitudes, at least at the tree level, say, and I could try to write down an effective action which describes the interactions of these particles. Tomorrow, I'm going to describe an alternative way to do this calculation to derive the low energy effective action for string theory without having to do all of these Feynman diagrams. So the idea So we get to this effective action from a sort of very tangential direction. So we're just going to ask what happens if we look at a string moving in a non-trivial space-time metric. So what happens if we take our action for the string and take the metric to be position dependent? So we'll discover that this makes sense only if the metric satisfies some equations of motion. We'll recover gravity, the Einstein-Hilbert action, and then analyze why this question is related to questions like this. Okay. So are there any questions about today's material? Because if there are no questions, maybe I can start saying a few things about what will be going on here. So, suppose you have some path integral like this. So in order to proceed with the usual technology we developed, we need to use Weyl invariants. So you need to make sure that this quantum field theory is Weyl invariant. Now, Weyl transformations act as nicely as before on the classical Lagrangian. But the question is, does this theory have Weyl symmetry at the quantum level? Now, in particular, the zero-order question is this theory invariant under rescaling, or constant rescaling of the metric on the worksheet? if you remember in quantum field theory, a risk, behavior under rescaling is just behavior under RG flow. In other words, this is an interacting theory now. It's not a quadratic theory anymore. If you imagine expanding this metric around flat space, right, you would say, okay, this is eta mu nu plus dot, dot, dot. For example, you could sit near a point in space-time and expand it out, right? The next term, you'll have something proportional to x, and then x squared, and then so on and so forth. So you should think about this as an interacting theory now on the worksheet. An interacting theory requires renormalization. So you will have to really introduce a renormalization scale on the worksheet and make sure that your metric, add counter terms to your Lagrangian in such a way that the final result is finite. And then you can ask what happens if you change the scale. If you change the scale, the renormalization scale will change. So you end up with RG flow equations for the couplings of your theory. But the couplings of your theory are now the metric. So I'm not talking about the coupling of the string theory. I'm talking about the couplings of the theory that lives on the worksheet, the two-dimensional theory which describes the motion of the string in space-time. So if the right-hand side is zero, the theory is scale invariant. If it's not zero, it's not scale invariant. If the theory is not scale invariant, we cannot even begin quantizing the string, the motion of the string. And it turns out that the right-hand side of this is actually quite interesting. As a result of a calculation, it's a messy but interesting calculation in two-dimensional quantum field theory. And it turns out to be essentially the Ricci tensor. So the right-hand side had to be some function of the metric in space-time. Everything can be done in a way that is essentially diffeomorphism invariant in space-time. I had to have two indices. So this is, okay, to be honest, I'm doing a perturbation theory in the, what you call the string tension, which is sort of the, the size which of the size of space-time which is explored by the string. So this is a dimensionful in space-time. So here there are some powers to the tension. Okay, I'm just giving you the leading order answer. But still it's quite nice because it suggests that the string can only move in a space-time which satisfies gravity's equation of motion. So and if you want to start understanding the relationship between these and that, you might ask yourself, okay, suppose that this metric was actually infinitesimally close to flat. Okay. So you could imagine expanding this out, expanding this exponential like this. Of course, so you, suppose you were also doing some scattering amplitude, so you had a bunch of other string mode inserted in your calculation. So now this looks like a scattering amplitude where the original particles are interacting with a coherent superposition of a whole bunch of gravitons. This expression is precisely what you use in quantum field theory to describe a scattering process in the presence of a coherent background of some particle in your theory, of some field in your theory. So the condition that the original expression was sensible was a particular condition that you could define Beresti symmetry, and becomes the condition that whatever you added to the action was Beresti closed, which means that these were on shell. So this makes it clear that the condition that sort of the nonlinear condition on Beresti's, you know, things working out becomes linearized, the condition that these gravitons are on shell. So this is an explanation of why here we are finding some nonlinear equations of motion for a metric, is that at the linearized order, all we were doing was to add a graviton to the scattering amplitude, and the graviton had to be on shell. Now this generalizes, you can imagine generalizing this now to every other string mode. Ask yourself what happens if I try to add this sort of the string mode vertex operator to the action, to the two-dimensional action, and see when is the model still well defined. And you get more complicated collections of equations of motion. And intuitively, you get an equation of motion for each field, for each state in your string theory. So I'm going to explain this again more in detail tomorrow. But so roughly, this is how the story is going to work. By probing answering the question, when can a string move in a certain background, we will discover a bunch of equations of motion, which can be argued coincide with the ones that you would get from just computing scattering amplitudes and writing down an effective action. Okay. I'm sorry I'm moving a little bit fast, but because we lost a bunch of lectures, I'm afraid of not even getting to mention what a superstring is. And that would be sad.